Welcome, everyone, to episode number 99 of Underserved. With me today is Tim Siebel, Vice President of Product Management at Bullhorn. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So how did you first become interested in technology way back in the day?
I took kind of a meandering path to tech. When I went to college, I had taken a lot of AP classes when I was in high school. And so I got to college and was through my sophomore year just from the beginning. I had taken most of my college requirements already and just had plenty of time. I had the good luck to be at school on a faculty scholarship. My dad worked at the hospital associated with Emory University. So I didn't have any financial pressure. I had lots of time and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I just started taking classes, see what I liked, see what I was good at, and make a decision after that. I'd been really interested in math in high school, economics kind of from a business standpoint. Probably not actually the best degree to go get if you're interested in business, but I was 18 and didn't really know anything. And computer science, because computers are cool and the future, and I don't know, like, should do computers. So I just started taking classes for those, and I couldn't really make up my mind across the three. But after 2 years of just kind of taking classes in all three of those disciplines, figured that I could actually just finish them all. I didn't actually have to force a decision, and so I did all of them.
You graduated with a triple major?
I did, by mistake, but I did. I really loved, from computer science, I really loved the algorithm. I really loved the approach of like a clever way to simply solve a complicated problem. I really loved that in the math too. As you start to get into higher level math, there's kind of some of that elegance in problem solving. But with computer science, I hated debugging code. Absolutely hated it. I remembered one time I spent like 3 hours debugging this program I'd written, only to find at the end that all of the logic was perfectly correct, but I'd used a semicolon instead of a colon or vice versa. And it was like 3 hours of my life I was never getting back searching for this one small typo. This was before all the great, like, helpful IDEs that you can get now. So, like, I may have had a very different approach if I had gone through all of this 5 years later, or a very different result if I had gone through all of this 5 years later. But as it was, I didn't want to do computer science. I didn't want to write code for a living.
I think that's remarkable that you got to do what so many people say college is supposed to be about. Try a bunch of different things and see whether or not any of them stick. I feel like so many people are pressured to, like, you got to get into your major. And like, in order to do that, you need to take all these gen eds. And like, there's only one track you can really take and never really stray far from it. So I think that's great that you pushed all three of them to the finish line.
I think that I'm not like a 5 or 10 year plan kind of guy. I don't necessarily walk in with a vision of how the future is going to unfold in the long term. Take kind of an agile approach to my life and iterate and make changes and pivot and fail fast, fail often, and, you know, kind of put myself in a position where I can see opportunity and take it.
Now, you were into playing music then as well, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of been a lifelong hobby of mine. I've played guitar since I was in sixth grade. I thought it would make me cool. It didn't, but I do still play. I still play in a rock band. Still doesn't make me cool.
What's the name of the band?
It's called the Broyles Street Band. It's a dad band. Like, it's a couple of dads that got together to drink beer and, you know, occasionally play some music. But we've been doing it for 15 years at this point.
Excellent. So way back then, you're playing some guitar in college. You like take courses around it too?
I did. Yeah. I had an opportunity to take a bunch of music classes. I took a bunch of jazz guitar classes with Gary Motley, a local Atlanta jazz musician who taught there. And then also took a bunch of classes with a really great teacher, Dr. Everett, who was into electronic music and had an electronic music lab at Emory. So it was really fun, like, you get to go into the lab and just there's tons and tons of hardware. So much of it is software based today. But this was before kind of the PCs were capable of doing all of that. And so you get all of this dedicated equipment, you know, with its own set of four processors in it so that it could like do delay effects or synthesizers and all this old analog equipment. Took a bunch of classes with that, got to go in and play around with that, write music and hang out in the lab.
I remember seeing like all that MIDI stuff back then, and I found it remarkable that they would make the music perfect, you know, line up all the notes, and then intentionally mess them up a little bit to make it sound more human, quantizing. Do you have to do that at all?
Yeah, for sure. So it certainly like covers a lot of bad playing, but then everything sounds robotic because perfection is not how human sounds. I have done some recording of the band that I'm in occasionally, and we've always found that we take the drummer, and in order to get everything sounding really tight, you want to quantize it. But if you do it too much, you lose all of the human sound. And so what we would do is split the drum track on all of the bass drum and the snare drum, which really holds kind of the key to the rhythm from the drum track. And then we would quantize that. And that would just kind of pull all of the toms and the cymbals and the hi-hat along with it. But it wouldn't fix mistakes in that. It wouldn't fix kind of like subtle imperfection. But you end up with this really tight sounding drum track because the bass and the snare are like dead on, but everything else kind of still gives you that feel. So you like half quantize it. Interesting approach to kind of getting it tight without getting it robotic.
All right, I'm going to scribble down notes in case I'm ever in another band. So you graduate from Emory, three majors, probably close to a minor in music. What do you do after that?
So you graduate right as the dot-com bubble bursts and you get a job at a restaurant serving burgers at Mick's Diner. Continue looking for a job. And I found one fairly quickly at a company called N-League. And Coca-Cola had spun up a incubator during the dot-com run-up.
As did everyone.
That's right, as did everyone. But they're such a large organization and so slow, and like they're not a technology organization, so they were like very behind the curve. And they hadn't actually gotten the incubator started until after the bubble had burst. Presumably, someone was immediately like, man, this thing's over, we should shut it down. But it took 4 years to shut down. So like there was this very weird startup incubator in this post-dot-com bubble era. And that was my first job working at this software company.
And what were you doing there?
This company was probably 10 to 15 years ahead of its time, leading edge semantic search. So this is something that's pretty common now, you see all over the place, but it's driving context and understanding out of like how words are used together instead of just doing a pure text search. So it's the ability to distinguish between Paris Hilton, the person, and Paris Hilton, the hotel. So that's it. It's driving that second, that deeper semantic understanding of the terms rather than just the pure text version. We were using it for this problem Coca-Cola had around their CRM and how they managed who they sell to. Coca-Cola has a lot of data, but they've got this very complicated understanding of a client where they're selling Coca-Cola to Chick-fil-A. The Chick-fil-A is owned by a guy that owns franchises. So he owns three Chick-fil-A's. He also owns two Blockbusters back when those used to be a thing. But one of those Chick-fil-A's is in a stadium. And that stadium is owned by a city. And the restaurant there is serviced by Cisco. And so you have this question of like, who are you actually selling your product to? And how do you go and find like everywhere where Cisco is kind of the person that's receiving your product? And how do you understand that this franchise owner has all of these other franchises that you're also servicing? And they didn't have a good way to understand that. And we're exploring how to use this semantic search to be able to structure the information in a way that you could kind of slice and dice it any which way, search through it, like all of this kind of cool visualization. It was super interesting. It was very kind of theoretical. We got to working prototype, but we never got to like user adoption, and the company shut down pretty abruptly. Coca-Cola finally shutting down their incubator.
Someone woke up and said, yeah. Wait a minute, yeah. Turn the switch off.
Someone woke up 4 years earlier and said, turn the switch off. It just took a really long time for the paperwork to go through.
So you abruptly end there. What do you end up doing next?
So in the last kind of year of that, we had had a consultant in Jeff Burgett he was starting his own company. He was trying to do it without funding. So he was trying to bootstrap the whole thing. And so he'd taken a consulting role with NLeague as he was trying to bootstrap this company. He was also in the midst of selling this big project to cable company software provider. And he was like, this is a great team. Why don't you guys all come and work for me? He was one of three people in this company. And then suddenly he brought on like five of us from NLeague and kind of had a company in a box. That was my next role. And so just kind of got pulled along by this co-founder. As I said earlier, I like no five-year plan, right? I'm just going to take advantage of things as they come up. And so I followed him and he was a really great mentor, taught me an awful lot. But one of the first things he taught me was what you're doing is product management. Come do it for me. I'll train you. I didn't know product management was a thing. I think that's probably pretty common for 15 years ago. People found product management by mistake or happy accident in this case. And I think today it's better understood and people actually like graduate from college wanting to do it. But back then, I just happened to find a guy that knew what it was.
You're like, I got three majors. I don't need a fourth. I can figure this out.
Yeah. That's right.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
So what is Celldon Systems doing there? You said that their customer were like cable companies?
Yeah, so we provided monitoring software for cable companies. Cable gets referred to as CATV, which is cable antenna television. Like the original business model for cable was like up in the New York or Philadelphia area, where there's a large metro city and then mountains and then towns on the other side of the mountains. The people on the other side of the mountains didn't get any of the television, the TV signal broadcasts, right? There's NBC and CBS on the other side of the mountains and they crossed a mountain and they didn't get any of it. And so some industrious people went and put a big antenna on the top of the mountain and then run cables down to everyone's house. That's all the first run of cable TV was doing, is running the antenna signal from the top of the mountain so you could pick up the same channels they had in New York on the other side of the mountain. And that was a business you built with like a truck and a shovel. That's all you needed. And if the TV went out because there was a thunderstorm, like, you might be mad, but we weren't going to do anything about it. And it wasn't like a really a major inconvenience, right? But as those companies started to try to provide data and voice over IP to people's houses, it completely changed the uptime requirements for their networks. Became mission critical, like even for a house. And I mean, you know, particularly now that we're all on Zoom all the time. But 10, 15 years ago, if you wanted to be able to provide voice over IP, you're competing with Ma Bell, Run Copper out everywhere. And probably some of your listeners have never had a landline, but that thing never went down. Like it didn't matter what was going on. You'd have no power and the landline still worked. You could call someone. To compete with that kind of required a big change from that, you know, shovel in a truck. It's a lot more technology. That's what we're doing. We're helping build that software. So being able to monitor like cable modems and see if they're up or down, be able to like see where there are issues in the network. And the primary thing that we were doing, the primary product we built was for battery monitoring for amplifiers in the cable system. So these cable systems are just long, long runs of coax cable. You get signal degradation and you get noise that gets introduced into the system. And so they have these amplifiers that can clean the signal up, boost it, and then send it on its way. And those are critical to running the network. But as soon as power goes out to one of these amplifiers, everything downstream loses signal. Everything down that entire branch of the network. They've got battery backups in for all of these amplifiers. And if you drive along the road and you look up, instead of looking straight, you should do this while you're the passenger, but look up instead of looking straight. And you probably won't go a quarter mile before you see a gray box on a telephone pole that says Alpha on it. And Alpha is kind of with the leading supplier of these battery backup systems in the United States. And that's an amplifier that's making sure everyone downstream gets their cable signal. So we built software that would monitor these batteries and see if they're online, if they're running on battery, how much time do they have left, starting to get into like predictive analysis of the decay of the battery. You could test the batteries remotely so that if a storm is coming, you can see if the batteries are holding charge so that you can start to tell how long they're going to function in a power outage, proactively replace the ones that you need to. And then these cable companies to provide this level of service for VoIP to compete with the telephone, they actually send people out in storms with a generator, and they'll chain the generator to the telephone pole and plug the amplifier in, and then drive circuits around filling up these generators with diesel. Like, that's someone's job. It's this kind of like wild thing that you don't even like, seriously, that's what they do? That's how they solve this problem? So that's what we were doing at Seldon Systems.
So round robin diesel delivery just to keep the cable stuff running.
That's right. You got to know where they are so that you can proactively get out there and make sure it's not due to a service interruption, because they can't call you to tell you that their phone is down.
So after that, you had a brief time where you did a startup with a friend and worked with your wife for a bit.
Yeah, we looked at trying to get a startup off the ground with a friend, and kind of really exploratory, and didn't go anywhere. Mostly I helped my wife, who has her own music business, was helping her find ways to grow her client base. She's got a bunch of teachers that work for her as well. And, you know, I did that for a while. And after about 6 months, she was like, thanks for your help. Please stop.
Please get another job.
Yeah, please. Just something else. You need to get out of the house. This is not great for our marriage. You've helped enough.
So after that, you decide to help the folks at SimpleSea instead?
Yeah. So I moved to a role at SimpleSea as a product manager. I've stayed in a role as product manager kind of for my entire career, but I've never done the same thing twice. I've moved industries a lot. Changing industries helps keep the job interesting and fresh, and that there's a lot to go and learn, but there's also, I have enough knowledge of how to go and get software built that I can be effective. So I started at SimpleSea. They had a fledgling product, but it was kind of internet for the elderly. People who had not traditionally used computers, but felt like they were getting left behind and wanted to be able to communicate with their grandkids and kind of be a part of what everyone else was doing and not feel isolated in their old age. And so they had this product that had been put together, and we were out testing it in a bunch of senior living spaces. And as we were out doing it, there became kind of a couple of pretty glaring product issues. The first was, it's very expensive to support. You had this whole ecosystem of computer and modem and our software and everything else. We gave them a phone number that we would answer. And so if there was any sort of problem at all, we'd get the call. And, you know, you get all of those kind of the joke tech support calls you hear about, like, well, have you turned it on? And like, oh no, how do I do that? You know, that sort of thing. And it was kind of very hard to manage that, hard to see how that would scale. And then our target customers were aging out. There's only a fairly small window of people who had retired but not used computers in their day job or not had like this kind of mobile phone experience, right? The market was shrinking as we went along. So we really started thinking about what else could we do. As we had been in these kind of computer labs that we'd set up, senior living facilities, the people that ran these facilities would bring us people that were like, oh, I think this person would be really interested in learning how to use a computer. They would also bring us people who had some level of dementia. And they were like, well, these two nice young men are here, and Dorothy will get along great with y'all. And here, you look after Dorothy. And with some level of dementia, there's no way that we were going to teach her people how to use email or even use a mouse. Like, trying to teach someone how to use a mouse is very confusing. And as we were trying to figure out what to do, you know, how to kind of have a positive interaction with these residents of these assisted living facilities, we discovered there were a number of ways that we could interact using the computer as a tool to really help people open up and really help them overcome aspects of their dementia for a short period of time. So we would show people pictures of, you know, places like, why don't we take a tour of the world? And I'm going to show you some pictures. As we started showing pictures of Hawaii, suddenly this person who had been like pretty closed off and pretty like short answers and not super engaged would light up and tell us this kind of detailed story about how they went to Hawaii on their honeymoon with their husband and provide all of these details about this. And then we're like, wow, that was amazing. And the next time we saw her, we'd be like, so let's talk more about your honeymoon with your husband. And she'd get kind of like tight and anxious, and became apparent she couldn't remember. She couldn't recall her honeymoon with her husband. But if you showed her pictures of where she went, then suddenly she was able to engage in all this. We were super excited about this kind of discovery. We went on to realize that we had rediscovered something, right? This was kind of a fairly well-known thing, and that there were a number of non-drug interventions for people with dementia. And this was one of them, being able to provide a prompt for a memory. Music therapy is another one that's kind of very popular. There's another one that we refer to as trusted voice, but it's if you hear a message from the voice of a loved one, even if you can't identify who that person is, you're more likely to trust that message than from a stranger. And if you hear a message in the first language that you learned, you're more likely to understand it and respond positively than in a second language. And so we built a system that was able to kind of pull all of these non-drug therapies together and provide them dementia care facilities. The staff would provide the kind of intervention that the person needed. Like, is it we're trying to get them like to transition into bedtime? Are we trying to get someone to go to lunch? And combine that with information from the family about this person's life history to be able to create really kind of rich, tailored therapies for this person. Very hard to scale that beforehand because it requires a lot of personal knowledge about the individual, and the staff turnover at these facilities was too high to be able to kind of manage that sort of thing. So we were able to kind of scale that through the use of technology. It was really exciting. It was super rewarding to go and make a material difference in somebody's life that was struggling with what is a terminal illness, really help humanize people as they kind of went through their end of life. It was a palliative care product, but it made a material difference.
What was one of the metrics they used to measure its effect on folks?
Yeah, so we ran a study to see how people ate and drank at mealtime, because malnutrition and dehydration are actually leading causes of death in the further on dementia care facilities. And we found that when people had these therapies kind of to help get them out of the room, to help them understand what the next part of their day was, they ate more and they drank more, which, you know, leads to a healthier person and better long-term outcome.
Syrinx has spent a lot of time and effort over the past 25 years building our reputation for quality and our brand. There was one big problem, though. No one could pronounce our name correctly.
Person on the street, brand testing, take one. Hi, can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
That's a really good guess.
Really?
Now, how would you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
Not even close. Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx.
Luckily for us, Syrinx was acquired in 2022 by the DeWinter Group. We're rebranding Syrinx under DeWinter's highly regarded technology consulting arm, Maris Consulting Group. We bring Syrinx's deep technology delivery experience, and they bring broader delivery capabilities and a new identity as Maris.
Here's what you can count on from the unified Maris. We are now a nationwide powerhouse when it comes to technology consulting, from DevOps to developers, to project managers, to business systems.
So join me in welcoming our future as Maris. Hopefully people will have an easier time pronouncing this one.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maris.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maurice.
Is that your uncle's name? Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Mars.
That's a planet.
Maybe not.
So contact Maris today, and we'll help you get your project done on time and on budget. You can call us at 408-297-7500, or you can find us on the web at mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
Well, after doing some good and working in a bunch of startups, you decide for your next step to go somewhere bigger?
That's right. The first three places I worked were all startups. The first one folded. The second two were successful enough to kind of continue, but not successful enough to ever hit that big growth phase. And there was always kind of, where's the investment coming from? And how are we going to turn this into something that's bigger? Some trouble with executive leadership as well. And so for my next role, when I went out to market looking for a new job, my primary requirement for a new company was that they were profitable. That's all I was really looking for. Was I wanted a technology company that had customers, right? Like, it's a pretty wide search criteria. But I also didn't want to go and work somewhere huge. I really liked the small company environment. I really liked that kind of scrappy startup thing where you're like, there's something to go and do, and it's not my job, but I can go and do it, and I can have personal growth, can learn all sorts of new things and have opportunities that I wouldn't necessarily get in a larger place. So that's what I went looking for, and I found PeopleNet, and they were about 120 people, but the leader in North America in time and attendance in staffing, right? So we've gone very niche. PeopleNet did not have product management. The salespeople talked directly to the developers, which probably that should induce an audible groan in much of your audience, right?
And in the movie Office Space.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It was not working well. But, you know, they'd built a successful company. I think someone probably just told the president, like, what you need is a product manager. It's a role. You're missing it. It's called product manager. So they hired me as the first product manager at PeopleNet. And I think they kind of are like, oh, yeah, no, that's working better. That is what we needed. We do need someone to sit between sales and our developers. It makes everyone happier. The customer gets a better product. The developers are happier. The salespeople can go out and sell. And so we started hiring more product managers, and I kind of took over as in charge of the product management team and built out a team. That was my first real foray into managing people and trying to figure out how to be a good leader, decent boss.
So PeopleNet is one of the leading providers of time management for the big staffing firms, the Randstads, the Adeccos, Kelly, Manpower, punching in, punching out, blue collar, white collar, you name it. Did you ever figure out how to get consultants to fill out their timesheets on time? Asking for a friend.
No, it's impossible. In staffing, everyone's paid hourly. So if they don't fill out their timesheet, they don't get paid. And they still don't fill out their timesheet. Right? You still have to remind them to fill out their timesheet. And you see some really strange behavior too. You know, you see people that are like, well, I've earned enough money for this year, and I think I'm going to earn less next year. I want to defer my salary in the beginning of the year so that my tax bracket will be lower. So in mid-November, I'm just going to stop turning in timesheets. And then after New Year's, I'll turn them all in. And suddenly you've got 6 weeks of time that you've got to pay and figure out how to go as a staffing company, figure out how to go bill and get the client to not be like, that was last year. Like, leave me alone.
I don't know. They work 240 hours the first week of the year.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It sounds like it shouldn't be that hard, right? Like, you punch in, you punch out, you get your time. That's that. And like, it feels like it should be simple, but it's extraordinarily complicated to manage all of the different ways that staffing wants to be able to manage and pay their employees, all the different ways that their clients require the time to come in, and then layer on top of that, that you're doing this on a national scale. And that means you've got to work in California with all of their myriad laws about what is required to be able to get a valid time card in. And then because this is staffing, it's not just your obligation to pay someone, right? You're turning around and you're billing this time out to the clients. And so in order to get them to do that properly, you've got to try and get them to approve the time before invoicing. Because if they say, yeah, Tim did come and work 40 hours a week, then it makes them much less likely to be able to say, well, I'm not paying for Tim's time.
Which is good and works unless Tim, you know, in an effort to optimize things, starts putting his time in ahead of time, 8, 8, 8, 8, 8, putting the snowman in there, putting some placeholder entries, but then doesn't end up working all that time, or there's a holiday. I believe you had one particular story about that.
Yeah, this is the opposite problem from doesn't put in their time. This is puts in time that they didn't actually work. one of the things approvers can do is dispute the time that has been entered. Like, I disagree. That is not what they worked. And they can provide a reason. And so the funniest reason, the best reason, the worst reason, it's one of those things, was, you know, 8 hours on Monday and Tuesday is great, but it shouldn't be eight on Wednesday. It should have been four because they were arrested from the shop floor. And then on Thursday and Friday, it had been changed from 8 to 0 just with the in jail, right?
I would have to add that timesheet entry in jail.
In jail, yes.
So ultimately, that company gets acquired by Bullhorn. That's how you become a Bullhorn employee?
Yeah. So Bullhorn is kind of the leading provider in staffing for front office capability and has been for 20 years. You know, staffing is about finding talented people and putting them to work on a temporary basis. And so the front office software is part kind of CRM and sales, right? It's about finding opportunities. And then it's part like recruiting and human capital management, right? Because you're trying to find people, trying to find exceptional talent that then you can go and place. And so you're doing kind of the sales piece, you're doing kind of the onboarding and recruiting. And that's what Bullhorn did kind of very, very successfully for 20 years. In kind of the 2016, 2017, looking at how we go from being a piece of a staffing company's technology stack to becoming a more complete technology provider for these customers. And the first piece of that is making sure we become the system of record for all of a staffing firm's data. So that means moving from just this kind of front office function that Bullhorn have traditionally done and moving into collecting people's time, making sure they're showing up to work, being able to send out invoices and get people paid. And so Bullhorn bought PeopleNet as kind of the first pillar of that journey to provide kind of a fuller software stack to staffing firms.
Catherine Kruger introduced the two of us. Glad she could put us in touch so you could be a guest on the show. She's been heavily involved in working with Bullhorn at the Winter Group, and I've gotten to know a little bit of what it's capable of. And I was surprised because I had seen through, you know, since the early 2000s, all sorts of staffing companies, they'll buy something that handles most of what they need, but maybe it doesn't do invoicing, or maybe it doesn't do timesheets, or maybe it doesn't do time off requests or whatever. And they would get these little duct tape systems that they would build out of SharePoint or whatever in order to plug the gaps. But it really does seem like Bullhorn has got the soup to nuts capability actually implemented.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, staffing is an industry of exceptions. Staffing firms have trouble competing on margin because it's a thin margin business. And so they compete on level of service. And that means if a client asks that invoice be, you know, printed on blue cardstock and delivered by hand on a Tuesday before noon, then they'll find a way to say yes to that request, right? And so having something that has been custom built for staffing from the ground up, understanding all of those things really allows us to be able to provide a complete solution for staffing rather than trying to repurpose software that doesn't manage some of the intricacies of the staffing vertical. I think that staffing is also in a really interesting place. Staffing is in the business of finding great people to solve problems. And, you know, the saying, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Well, if your business is finding great people to solve problems, then when you have a problem, you get some great people and you go and solve it. And so it ends up being kind of a very people-heavy process to running staffing firms instead of using technology. And staffing is kind of hitting this point where there needs to be this technology inflection. There needs to be digital transformation. And you need to be able to start leveraging things like AI and automation and advanced analytics that really require that digital transformation within your business. And at the same time, there are these new competitors emerging in the market that are kind of gig economy, making the argument that you don't need a recruiter and a salesperson or an employer of record. What we're going to do is you're just going to have an app and say, I need a UX designer for 2 weeks, and then you'll have one. And won't that be great? And that's kind of a new competitive threat. And staffing is kind of a unique point of being able to having that technology change. You know, it's kind of funny to think that there's still that sort of technology change happening out there in the marketplace when, you know, Netflix so thoroughly crushed Blockbuster about 10 years ago. And like banks made this digital transformation 10 years ago, that there's still kind of companies that are going through that. But I think that in staffing, we're seeing a lot of that and being able to provide kind of this very specific platform with, you know, Bullhorn's a 1500 person company and it's just focused on staffing. So being able to have the resources to go and do that has been super exciting.
I am amazed that that's still a thing. I remember back when I was at Monster in 2000, they had Monster Talent Market. And the idea was that people could put up their abilities and people could bid on their time in order to do stuff. And it was kind of like an auction atmosphere. And they were just way too far ahead of their time. I think nowadays with like the Fivers and so on, that sort of thing would really catch on.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that we're definitely seeing now some ideas that have been out there for a long time, like, wouldn't it be great if I could use AI to just make my job better? Like, that's been something people have been thinking about for 15 years, but is something that's only really started happening in the last like 6 to 12 months, it feels like, in a way that is kind of broadly applicable.
So you started after the acquisition in 2017, you've been promoted a few times now, currently vice president of product. How has your role changed over that time?
Yeah, so when we were purchased, I was in charge of product and had the small company title inflation title of chief product officer, you know, a 120 person company with three people reporting to me or six people reporting to me, whatever. You know, I kind of came in and they were like, all right, well, you're managing people and you want to manage people. So, you know, we're going to put you in charge of our product owners and we'll make you the manager of all the product owners. And I was like, you know, if you put me in that job, I'm leaving. Like, that is not what I'm good at. And it is not what I want to do. And they're like, okay, well, great. Well, what do you want to do? It's like, I like building products. I've had a bunch of success with it and it's fun and I really enjoy that. And they're like, well, do you mind going back to being an individual contributor? I'm like, I don't care. Like, I don't care about the title. I don't care about the reports. I want to be doing something fun and exciting. And they were like, well, we've got this major new initiative. I was like, yes, that's what I want to go and do. And so I moved back into a individual contributor role and got started on building out this kind of middle office software for the staffing industry. And I think I went all of like 2 weeks before they were like, hey, we're going to give you a direct report. Is that okay? And I was like, I felt so free for 2 weeks.
Just when I thought I was out, they pull me right back in. They
pull me back in. And so, you know, over the last 5 years, we've been growing, you know, and it started out, it was in an architect and some whiteboards and, you know, some consultants providing some subject matter expertise. And that was it. It was kind of very scrappy. And then we got a team. And, you know, I think now we're up to 8 teams and got a big kind of product organization that's supporting this product and this investment from Bullhorn. And so, you know, I've just kind of grown through that. Bullhorn's a great place to work. It's a really fantastic culture and has a very, very strong culture of giving people a career path so that they can grow and, you know, invest back into the company. I've been lucky to end up at kind of a good place. Again, fortuitously, like no 5-year plan, just kind of happened and here I am, but I've been loving the journey.
When you're not at work, you mentioned sometimes you play some music with the dad band. Any other hobbies, whether or not they involve technology?
I love to get outside as long as there's some adrenaline involved. I don't want to go for a hike or camping in the woods, but if you give me a mountain bike or a snowboard, then I'm happy. I like going through the woods fast.
Big fan of it myself as well. So Tim, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you.
You as well. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.